this statement last time, which I would like you to reconsider and to put it so in shape that you can, like any mathematical equation, compare the facts with which you have to deal, whether they come up to expectation, whether these simple laws show their validity. You will remember that I tried to show you last time that what you call ordinary and what you call extraordinary, from William James' point of view, from my point of view, should be labeled differently. That the ordinary was that which was unconsciously done, without recognition and without risk. You here do the ordinary when you take a ticket and come up to Dartmouth. Obviously, Eleazar Wheelock and his first class came here under great danger of life. It seemed absolute folly to go into the wilderness here, and even the Baal of Rum could not quite reconcile people to the danger of a pleurisy. And there we call this extraordinary, that they came here. You would agree. Still, this is a concession to our blindness as everyday people. We forget that we owe this order, our own order, the ordinary, that we sit here and have this regular course with five deans looking after your running noses. That this kind of motherly care which the modern Dartmouth student receives is the result of people who did not care whether they had a coat. Probably they had no handkerchiefs even for their coat, and certainly no Dick's house. And so there was no motherly care, but there was hardship. Can we call this extraordinary? I don't think that we call it extraordinary, because they preceded us. Order, as we experience is unconsciously, we call ordinary. Now, I don't think that the word extraordinary, and therefore I put here falsely called extraordinary, that the man who climbs a mountain first or who found the college, he's not extraordinary, because there is no order yet. Just without an order. So he is organizing or ordering, or as I like to call it, founding. And we call here for the fathers of this country the founding fathers. Which means that they had nothing ordinary to before themselves, therefore they needed consciousness, the highest amount of consciousness. You can here, so to speak, do it in your sleep. The first class of Dartmouth men could not. They had to go all out, as we say. And this all out involves, gentlemen, the totality of your faculties, of the whole man. And therefore, I propose to you that between the ordinary and the extraordinary, the prevailing distinction should be the whole man's effort, total effort, and the partial effort. You are only partially present. The rest of you is asleep. And a man who does something under his own responsibility and nobody has a proof of it, and he has to prove it to the whole world that this is the thing to be done, he has to do it wholeheartedly. And you can do it wholeheartedly. And you do it. And most, the greatest impression anybody gets from American youth at this moment is your faintheartedness, your timidity, your mental timidity. You don't wish to be anything but a conformist. And a conformist is a man who is faint-hearted. And therefore, there's a wholehearted action involves that all your faculties, mind and heart and genitals, passion, work, handicraft, skill, cleverness, everything are wide awake. Partial action means that you imitate other people and therefore don't have to be conscious. So I actually propose, it's very important, terribly important, gentlemen. You cannot understand history if you cannot distinguish between the wholehearted life and the faint-hearted life. even the word partial isn't a very exceedingly clear expression. Have you to propose another contrast to wholehearted? I would be very glad to receive it. Can anybody make a proposal? How we should call the ordinary routine life that you go, I mean, and come as everybody does? Just to have some clear contrast to wholehearted. What would be? I mean, faint-hearted, I don't even wish to reproach it. I do many things not faint-hearted, and you too, but just, as we say, ordinary, you see. That is, without thinking, it's established. The groves. Yeah?
Passive.
See?
Passive.
It's probably a very good word, in fact, but since the modern activist is the most passive man, because he only used five things, he wouldn't recognize himself under the label, you see. Can you see this? That the people, what we do for passive means that you skid along on the highways and byways of civilization. But the man thinks he goes 90 miles an hour, so he thinks he's terribly active. And he says he's just skidding. You see, that would not open his eyes to the fact that he's very ordinary. Can you see this? Partial is perhaps, I would even say, divided. Most people are divided in their energies. They don't have all their faculties concentrated. Well, the praisers of and appraisers of nature think, of course, never that natural has this attitude of lukewarmness. You see, they would not. Sure, but that's a compliment to a banker. You see, he feels that's the only way you should be. You should be prosaic. You see, poetry is for fools. Yeah, I mean, I agree, but he doesn't see why I should ever be anything but prosaic. I know a very rich banker. He married his daughter to a Dupont. You think that's an occasion to celebrate. He was a rich man. And he went to his neighbors and borrowed the flowers for the wedding. He really was a prosaic man. Because he couldn't make a wholehearted effort to celebrate the wedding of his daughter, even to a Dupont. He only calculated that it was cheaper to have other people's flowers with our understanding. So he's prosaic, all right. But if I tell him he's prosaic, he says, that's how I want to be. However, if I tell him that he makes only use of part of his faculties, we cannot deny that it would be better to make, you see, or there must be occasions where the whole man is provoked. Obviously, if the young man, the son-in-law of this banker, would marry the daughter half-heartedly as the stepfather-in-law, there would be no children. There would be no children. Potency and power, gentlemen, come from wholeheartedness. Impotence comes from dividedness. You see, girls are frigid and women are impotent when they are divided in their loyalties and in their interests. Very simple. See? Now the banker says, prosaic, you have children, can't be prosaic. This won't work. So I need something that you know.
Arcadia.
See?
Arcadia. Indifference.
Well, it is quite a serious problem, gentlemen. We have, the old list is ordinary, extraordinary. As long as William James or myself talk in these terms, we cannot sell the truth, because we make this concession to the ordinary way of life as though it was the primary, and the extraordinary is just a kind of additional folly, enthusiasm, you see, ranting. It's unnecessary. Obviously, the founding fathers, or the people who came in the wilderness and founded this college, are our support. They did something wholeheartedly, therefore we can do it half-heartedly. Therefore, we have to find an expression by which the ordinary points towards the whole all-out effort as its condition. Do you see? Therefore, the word extraordinary and ordinary are built up in the wrong sequences. Look at the same. I'll give you another example. We have here some Catholics, I'm sure. Now, you know, in this country and in Europe too, for the last 100 years, the children of the darkness have called the church an international institution. If it is an international institution, it is not older than the nations. Then the nations are there first, and the international is a kind of sugarcoating of the frontiers between the nations. Obviously, the church was nothing of the kind ever. It's a universal ecumenic church, it's the Catholic Church, and it is there at the very first moment in the person of her founder. She is one and all for all mankind. She is total. She is wholehearted. If it isn't, there's no church. If Jesus was not as much an American as he was an Asiatic, or as he was a Japanese and a Chinese, he has never been, because he has just missed his whole mission. If you can say that he was a Jew, in as the Jews now try to tell you, these modern Jews who try to sell you Jesus as a Jew, then he died in vain. The cross is perfectly superfluous. The wall, the partition between the different nations, then was never torn down. Now, the modern enemies of the faith say very cleverly, international. The church is an international and therefore a very dangerous institution. That has been the attack on Christianity right along. First against the Catholics, then by the racists against the Protestants, just as well. You can also attack Protestantism as a reacting a standard which isn't wholly German. And therefore, as you know, Mr. Hitler said, Christianity has to go, or at least I have to be Christ, as he used to say. He did. And this very simple, gentlemen, the word international is a very clever way for abolishing all ecumenic, all humanitarian unity among the human race. Because then international is second, and national is first. Can you see that? There are any number of such words. Gentlemen, children and fairy tales and poetry are called by these logicians prelogical. Then it means that they are immature and they are to be superseded by logic. And so what is creative and what is the necessary foundation for all later logic is declared to be just a little preamble, you see, just an eggshell to be sloughed off a very indecent, archaic youth movement of the human mind, and it should be as quickly as possible replaced by logic. I've just written, pardon me, an article on these three words, pre-logic and international and extraordinary. That is a very clever way of turning everything topsy-turvy. If you say pre-logical for poetry and for ritual and for liturgy, you come into this category of cybernetics, and you hasten to order a machine to replace you. Because then the logic, you see, is the highest and the necessary. The pre-logic is a causeway to the logic, but it's unnecessary and it is primitive and it should go as fast as possible. International, no church, no Christianity, no common destiny of mankind. The nations are there, and then we patch in some nice international institutions like this international education business of Mr. Holland or whatever goes on in New York for internationalism. Internationalism will never cure nationalism, then. We don't believe that. But the Americans think so, by the way. It's a very strange superstition which you have, that international is good enough. It will never replace nations, you see. By every word time you use the word international, you reaffirm your belief that the nation is there first, you see, and the international is second. Now, Jesus died on the cross and Adam was created to tell you that first God created men. And then we split into nations. And obviously, if you don't believe so, there's no hope for mankind. If nations are first, and international is an afterthought, because that may be an error. That may be then, that is not then at the core of the human problem. At the core of the human problem, however, is that we are one. Already, from the first day of creation. And then, of course, you can see it from the Anglo-Saxons and the Americans. We branch off, but we are branches of one tree. If you say international, you deny this. The church is not international, gentlemen, and the founding of a college is nothing extraordinary, and the marriage is normal. And all the days in which the wife has to wash the dishes, or of course I should have said the husband has to wash the dishes, in the kitchen, they are the exceptions from the marriage state, because they are not ecstatic, as you say, they are prosaic, and they are subnormal, they are submarginal. And every day in which the husband has to do the dishwashing is a danger to the love affair between the two people, obviously. If the woman overdoes it and asks too many chores from the husband, he'll run away.
Are you an American?
No, not at all. I hope to be, become one. All my life. What do you mean?
I mean, in thought as well as a citizenship.
I have tried to immigrate into this country very strongly. That's why I have forwent many things out of at least American horses, I understand something. I'm raising American horses.
So you were
Winding up?
Well, you speak of we Americans, so you weren't part of us.
Well, I'm not 20. How old are you?
20.
I'm here in this country now 22 years. Perhaps we are both not Americans.
So you're referring to this wholehearted man. I don't quite understand. So you mean the wholehearted man is just one aspect, just one thing he does to go above the ordinary? How many are
no, your neighbor over there, I don't know if you sit there as last time. I tried to convince him that one action, once in a lifetime, you see, that he could marry at 28 and hadn't wasted his powers of love in a dissipated life, would show be more important, that he could still concentrate on one decision as whom to marry and as really to marry at 28. Compared to all the ordering of ice creams daily, every day in his life. That's the problem, you see?
Now, you say that there are a lot of these ordinary men, a lot of these wholehearted men who make these wholehearted actions, or there are very few in relation to the rest of the mass.
Everybody is only, he's talked into this situation that he is told that his everyday imitative actions are more important, constitute him more as man than the few acts which really count in his life. I hold that the few acts which count in your life constitute who you are, that they make you or break you. And that is not very interesting to look at your ordinary occupations if I do not see how you got a job, you see, and how do you carry it out over 10 years as a whole. Well, the small man too, I think every normal human being is to be found in his extraordinary moments. Can you see this? We are all extraordinary people. We are all, after all, vital people. I don't believe that this whole drabness which you have thrown, this wet blanket, which you are throwing over your own eyes when you judge mankind today, psychologically or historically or legally, you see, is what you really think of yourself. You judge yourself, you see, by your confidence that you will weather a storm, you see, and the everyday things you take in your stride. Here you are 4 years in college and you want to go to commencement. Now this commencement overshadows all the acts of the previous 4 years. Therefore, in these 4 years, you flunk the course, all right. As long as it doesn't endanger your graduating, it is just some sideline, you see, some side issue. It hasn't the same status as the one act which is condensed, you see, which condenses 4 years of life into its final outcome. You are born into a graduate, you see, into an alumnus one day. This birth is more important than all the mishaps that befall you on the way to this goal. Therefore, if I look at your ordinary work day, you see, in college, I do not really know why you are here. You are not here because of this one class here, you see. But you are here for this concentrated result of the birth of an alumnus. And as you say that you are a grammar school student, a high school student, and finally a graduate of a college, that's how you would sum up if you have to write up your curriculum, your experience anyway. You do it. But when you come to an analysis of what man is, then you always say he has to eat and he has to breathe, and you describe always the lower echelons of his being as though this was enough. I assure you it isn't. It wouldn't explain any one of your real decisions in life, anything of your friends, of your loyalties, of your ties with the rest of mankind, if I would judge you just by these lower things, which are like the hammer in your hand, an instrument of implementing the others. I once attended a lecture, gentlemen, on the reasons for history, and they said it's all in the glands. And as you know, America has been beset for the last 20 years by this fantastic idea that it's all in the glands. Well, of course it's in the glands, gentlemen. I hope I have very normal glands, quite strong. And I hope you have. But does this make up our real life? What do we do with these glands? Obviously, we do not just create 365 illegitimate children and with the help of these glands. But we build a nation, we build up an industry. The glands, therefore, can serve any number of sublime processes. The question is just which? So people in this country really believe, as I said, I listened to a lecture where this asinine speaker really said he explained anything by saying it's all in the glands. We understand world history by the glands. Gentlemen, just come to think of it for a moment. Men have had these glands for the last 6,000 or 7,000 years. And the history of mankind is very varied. And sometimes we build railroads, and in other we build balloons, and on it goes. And the glands are always the same. Therefore, the real question is, you see, why these variations? Why every year something different with the same energy, with the same fluid? It would be the same as if you say that the electricity which shines in the Capitol building, it explains the history of Congress. Because they have night sessions, and then the electric bulb, that's exactly like the glands, enables these people to work. But we are interested, one year this bill is passed, and another year this budget is passed, and the next year there's a declaration of war. Now that's the history of Congress, isn't it? And not the identity of illumination of the Capitol Hill. But you are such children, gentlemen, that when somebody comes to you and sends you this wisdom, it's all in the glands, that you bow to this man and pay him $100,000 and say, this is a great scientific discovery. It is just nonsense. Nothing else. Absolute nonsense, such explanations. They explain absolutely nothing, but they do away with your respect for what's really happening. In Union Theological Seminar, a man who is dead by now, he died in despair, he more or less took his own life. No wonder he was an analytical victim of analysis. And he taught on St. Augustine. So he taught that St. Augustine had a mother complex. And because his mother was a very pious Christian, all his life he was haunted by the mother complex. So a friend of mine, whom I told you the story, said, now, what of it if he had a mother complex? We are interested in the great deeds which he did on the basis of the mother complex. You may have a mother complex and amount to nothing, you see. So two people have a mother complex, but it's absolutely uninteresting that both have a mother complex because one is a great fellow out of his mother complex and the other isn't. I don't think he had one, but he said, my friend said, let's assume Mr. Aurelius Augustinus, Bishop of Hippo, had a mother complex. What of it? it's just the same as saying that he has glands. It is nothing of any importance. If it is, if you have a heart handicap, you're deaf. Well, you have to fight it. You have to overcome it. If you have a mother complex, if you are a great soul, you will overcome the mother complex. You will put it to good use. You will harness even your deficiency, like Helen Keller, who is a great person, because she said, well, I'm deaf. Does it explain Helen Keller, gentlemen? You look at 10 deaf people, and there's one Helen Keller, and the 9 others don't demand anything because they say, I'm deaf. The most famous Jew of the last 30 years is a man, Hans Rosenzweig, who was a great friend of mine. He was so sick with amyloidosis, with the shrinking of all his muscles, that it was incurable. And in 1920, he fell sick. And the books say that no one man with such sickness has ever lasted for longer than 2 years, because these people give up and go to bed and say, I'm doomed. He said, oh, I knew that I had to die all my life. There's no distinction now because I'm sick. And he decided on the day in which he was told that he had this sickness to begin to translate the Bible. So the most famous translation of the Bible by Martin Buber and Franz Rosenzweig was done by a man who had no life expectation of more than 2 years at best. And of course he had to die, but he lived 9 more years. 9 more years instead of 2. And as I said, wrote his most important, not philosophy, his most important, but the books for which he is famous now and known in these 9 years. So that's the difference between one man whom you remember and the 9 others who die in the first 2 years, because at the first moment that they are told that they have glands or that they have sclerosis or that they have a mother complex, they give up and say, I'm doomed, because the tension between my parents and myself is just so great that I cannot pass my examinations. You know these analytical cases. They are not very interesting. Build on your deficiencies, gentlemen. I have done this all my life. Everybody has deficiencies. They are your greatest assets. Turn them into these liabilities into something positive, and you suddenly become wholehearted people. A wholehearted man, gentlemen, takes everything he has as an asset. All his liabilities, like Helen Keller, or my friend, Franz Rosenzweig. And the faint-hearted man says, oh, somebody else tells me I have glands, so it's no use. The glands just dictate to me. So, what's this man? He's split. He left his glands erratically compounded. And there he goes, the poor man with his glands goes to waste. Any such description, gentlemen, of a man is typically partial. The only description of a man that would not destroy you and me is if somebody told me I am unique and I'm irreplaceable and I'm needed. You all want to hear that the world needs you. I assure you that it does need you. But most people tell you, no, you are just number 620 of your class. Gentlemen, if I hear this, I go to sleep. I become partial. Any description of a man, gentlemen, that he is a type, that he is melancholic or a sanguinic or choleric, that he is 6 feet tall, that he weighs 145 pounds according to the average, anything that tells you that you have a typical quality, discourages you. It means to tell you, don't do anything. People of your type are just this way. The only thing that helps you is to say, this man has never existed before. There may have been Smith in the world, but Wesley Hugh Smith just has never lived before. And this is the only wholeheartedness, gentlemen. A man can become wholehearted if the rest of the world confides in his wholeheartedness. Now, what is a whole heart, gentlemen? The heart is, first of all, full of surprises. It is immeasurably, it has the power to give infinite devotion, infinite, immeasurable effort. All other parts of our body you can measure. You can measure how many much weight you can lift with your hand. You can never measure what a human heart can do because it is delegated into you from the whole tree of life. All life has its mission, its embassy, its delegation in your building, in your prison, as your heart. Your heart is given you as a participant of the tree of life. It's inside you, yes, but it doesn't come from you. It's there before you are. And therefore, gentlemen, anything infinite, immeasurable, irreplaceable, indispensable, all the words beginning with I-N are matters of the heart. Everything finite, definite, determined, predetermined, explicable, replaceable, typical, are located in your members, in your limbs, in all the fragments of your body. They are fragments. And here, my dear man, what's your name? What's your name?
Leader.
Instead of prosaic, I offer you fragmentary. Fragmentary. Yeah? It's fragmentary. I think that's better than partial. Most of our days of life are fragmentary. They offer a picture of the man that isn't the whole man. He is there, wouldn't you agree? Can you see the point?
While you are here chewing your, what is it? You are only fragment here.
Now I think this long detour is not wasted if you keep in mind that fragmentary man is our normal appearance to the world. In the world of men, in society, we from politeness and tolerance and timidity and convenience and conformity, we appear to each other fragmentary. You just make sure that I'm right. You meet anybody on the street, you will admit that you always meet only a fragment of this man. His real worries, he won't tell you. I mean, he was just told that he had cancer, you meet him on the street and you say, how are you? And he says, I'm fine. That's very fragmentary, you know. He's so polite that he will answer this trite question, how are you, with the equally trite lie, I'm fine. Isn't that true? Have you ever thought, proposed to think what, how funny that is? It's just the beginning, you see, of wisdom, to begin with a statement that is objectively absolutely a lie. It's wrong. And yet it's only the introduction. 10 minutes later, he may tell you that he has cancer, you see. He can't tell you in the first place. Can you see this? If we begin with each other on the basis of fragments of our existence. Gentlemen, I think it will help you greatly if you say what we call ordinary people are fragmentary people. And I mean it in both senses, that the man inside of him has covered up many of his passions and doesn't look at the abyss of his being into his real power, but he has covered it up for the time being and he's just ordinary. You know, in America, if you want to reconcile the rest of mankind to your own existence, you have to say, I'm just an ordinary man. Lincoln said, you see, God made so many ordinary men, as you know, common men. But Lincoln, as you well know, expected every common man to have the power to become an uncommon man. That is his democracy. This is a reliance of the extraordinary power of the common man. Don't think that Lincoln wanted the common man to be just ordinary, but he expected in the common man to find the hero. This is his democracy. He said, no lords and no kings and no chieftains, You see, and no rich people will save the earth, but the hero that's in every human being. Isn't that simply true? How could a wartime president expect to run the country with common people who would always only do the ordinary thing? Every day during his presidency, people had to do the extraordinary thing. And he expected them to do. You think any battle can be won by ordinary men? Only by ordinary men who, out of their fragments, rise to the occasion, as we say, and become wholehearted. As the old Vermonters sitting together getting the news of Fort Sumter, there were five boys in our, may I say, hometown, will you forgive me? I think it's a great story, and they debated. And four of them debated, of course, the argument, should we go and fight? And the fifth say, well, I think I'll just go down to the railroad station. He went to the next recruiting office, you see. And that was his answer to the news of Fort Sumter. And in this very moment, you can see, anybody who goes with his whole body and mind to report as a recruiting officer, he's wholehearted. Whereas the others had only their reason arguing out the point, you see. And they didn't take their buttocks along. So most people, I mean, as you know, it's always very wonderful, the division of mankind. 20 people debate a question and one does something about it. And you will admit that all the people who debate Christianity, I have nothing to do with Christianity, but the one General Booth who did a very silly thing and founded the Salvation Army has done more to save the world than all the theologians in all the theological schools of America. Because he went and did it. So fragmentary, I think that's the result of this lesson. I didn't have this expression so clearly in myself before, and I think it's a good expression, it's much better than partial, because you must see that the whole organization of human society tends to fragmentarize our appearance, others, and our self-consciousness. It makes us polite. And the very curse of politeness, gentlemen, is that it fragmentarizes, because it turns only the smooth surface out and makes us concentrate on the smooth surface. And you begin to judge people according to the fact whether they have been polite to you, amiable, nice. Gentlemen, if you would take stock of your daily experiences of human beings, you won't do it. Formerly, 100 years ago, people were very exact and precise in keeping themselves to account and trying to find out whom they had met and what it meant. They kept a diary, as you know. And the diary was not just trite, it wasn't just gossip, but it was an attempt to realize what had happened to them. And if you would then try to turn the scales and to say, this man was polite to me, therefore I do not know him. This man was frank and brutal to me, therefore I know him. You would have learned a great lesson. But unfortunately, you do the opposite. When and as long as a man is smiling at you and polite, you say, how nice. And that's the wrong judgment. That's the wrong judgment. A man who honors you with his truth may be brutal, may have to be frank. He may have to break down this cement wall of politeness. Politeness is not good for truth. And it is much better to be able to stand the frank, brutal frankness of veracity, and therefore, as you know, a father doesn't owe his children politeness, but he does owe them the truth. And you do too. to your real friends. Instead, you have archery with everybody. So you have many roommates, gentlemen, but you have no friend. The friend is only the person who is truthful. One of you wrote a paper, strange paper, last term in the finals, in which he said that he had mastered every argument on the existence of God and against the existence of God. He was a philosophy major, and of course they all go to hell. And he had been able to say to himself, argument about the existence of God, that's done. I know everything, every point. And then he had a roommate. And funny enough, in this country, you can have a roommate and not talk to him seriously for a whole year, or even 2 years. And he said, all of a sudden, there was an evening in which he asked this other fellow, point blank, do you believe in God? And the other said, if you ask me, I have to admit, yes, I do. Oh, he was, of course, excited and said, now comes the argument of the other fellow, and I crush it. I'll break it. I'm ready. And the other fellow said, oh, don't argue. I have no reasons. I just do. So he moved from the argument, from the use of this little bit of a mind, to the existential position of the whole thing. We call it wholeheartedness, by the way, in modern slang, modern jargon, existential. Yes, it's a belated discovery by students and academic people of something the world has known since the beginning of Adam and Eve. Existentialism doesn't deserve any special notion. So I think the story is a great story, gentlemen. It took these men 2 years in college, asking how long they had lived together, 1 year and a half, before such an occasion arose, and then the story was over, because this poor boy, the major in philosophy, had only met people on the basis of argument, and not on the basis of respect. Not on the basis of insight into the real foreignness and strangeness of two human souls, and that he had to respect quite a different value, quite a different rootedness. This other man lived in reality, who said, I believe and I don't know why. And he believed, lived in this empty space of argument, gentlemen. It's a very passing thing. Today you have one argument, tomorrow you have another. So, frankness, brutal frankness, gentlemen, should be your measure, yardstick for human relations. But it isn't. You say that politeness is. But that's only true for the fuller brush salesman. Of course, he has to be polite, otherwise he's ejected out of the house. But in your other relations, gentlemen, what do you care for all the people who have been polite to you? The one man who cut up your cataract around your eyes and who told you the truth, he cannot be replaced by anybody else. There's usually only one man in a long, in many years, whoever tells you what all the rest of the world says about you. One man is good enough to tell you, you hate him for that. Very strange. Because you prefer to live as a fragment and to live among fragments, and you think the other people don't know who you are. They know very well, but they don't tell you. So you never can become whole. Because you see, why do we have to do this awkward term, repentance of sins? Why has this been introduced into our standards of life? Repentance, conversion, all these terms mean very little to you. You are all ready to go to heaven anyway, under all conditions. Gentlemen, repentance means the power to include into your existence your deficiencies, your shortcomings, and to know that the rest of the world says, oh, he has just this deficiency. And to give up the idea that everybody has to be polite and gloss over this deficiency and say that it doesn't exist. It does exist. Everybody. We all have these deficiencies. The conversion consists in your turning towards you, and instead of impassionately striving to your eccentric virtue, where you say, but I at least get an A in gymnastics. That's usually how people think of themselves. They think of their one high point in life. And the rest, they try to forget. The convert to himself, the convert to his reality, says quite indifferently, yes, this is my handicap, you see. And there I am strong. And as you know, every one of us has some points where he's perfectly honest with himself and doesn't blush and doesn't get excited because he has learned to bear with himself as we have to bear with others. So in all these respects where you admitted a negation in your own makeup, you are wholehearted. You don't look away from this. That's just the beginning, so to speak, of this whole story of becoming wholehearted. Take any reform in the community which looks desperate, city government, bribery, Tammany Hall, anything. You get a... If you list all your handicaps, you belong, of course, to one minority. You may be Jewish or you may be a Presbyterian, and the country, the town, is dominated by the Irish majority. So you say, I have not a chance to ever to reform this town because I'm the minority. If you say so, you can't reform the town. You have to say, I have this handicap, sure, and I will win just the same, despite all this handicap. Anybody in politics has many such handicaps, but the winner is usually the man who is an outsider. My role in life has been the outsider wins the race. The outsider for whom nobody is going to betting, for nobody will put up a cent. If you are the wholehearted person, gentlemen, in human history, it is always the outsider who wins the race. The men the others did not expect to win. But there must be a man who isn't frightened by his handicaps and admits them, you see. He shouldn't be blind. He shouldn't run like a stargazing reformer and say, I am the white hero in white shining dress, you see. But you should say, I'm really not the right man, but since nobody else does it, the least fitted men must be. Gentlemen, the heroes of history are the people who say, I certainly am not the man to do it, but I have to do it because nobody else does it. That's by and large the Lincoln's grandeur. He wasn't the best man in the eyes of his contemporaries, but he was, you see, the lesser evil or the available man. And he said, well, the vote election has fallen on me, so I do my best, and he did better than anybody else. He's not, in this sense, the predestined hero. You wouldn't pick the savior of the Union in the forms of Lincoln. He really was a very ungainly, awkward guy. And his doctor would have said, don't run for the presidency, it's not good for your digestion. You know, he had a very poor digestion. So, gentlemen, the hero of history is usually the man who is handicapped and of whom nobody thinks as a man. And he only does it because there's nobody else to do it. Because such a man is perfectly aware of his deficiencies and can only overcome them by total wholeheartedness. And the man with deficiencies must be more wholehearted than even the ordinary noble soul, you see, who is willing to go all out. That's a very strange thing, story, but if you think about it, I think you would find proof in your own experience why that is so. That the man who is, so to speak, coming forward because there's nobody else to do it is usually the most sober and his devotion to the cause is more total. He has to mobilize everything, including his deficiencies. Whereas the men, take the ordinary young man, athletic, he is drafted, he goes out on the battlefield, he'll do well as a second lieutenant, he'll lead his platoon, he'll be all there. Very fine men as for the soldiers. But it will be in the cadres of the army and he'll do what he's ordered to do. He'll do perhaps beyond the call of duty, something to get him the congressional medal. But you would still feel that they are, that is not the only man who would have done this bravely. But in the case of Lincoln or Bill Mitchell, you will find that, for example, the aggressiveness of Mitchell, it was a real handicap in dealing with these other generals. He antagonized them, and so on. Finally, he threw this antagonism into the breach and said, I must get this court-martial, he really wanted the court-martial, to get publicity, you see. I must bank on this, my antagonism, to get the public to listen to this whole story. Otherwise, we'll all run behind closed doors. Whenever a man does something which nobody else does, his deficiencies help. In the cause of Christianity, that's a very strange story. Paul was helped by his Jewish fanaticism before his persecutions of Christians. And I could even show you this about the Lord and about the prophets and about King David, that the whole Bible is shot through with this deep insight that the extraordinary or the founding or the wholeheartedness of a man is more provoked when he has to admit his shortcomings and include it into the bill of fare. Then, you see, he's all there. The whole public knows also what is, can be told against him. And the clear issue is not you do it for the sake of this man and his duty and his virtue. You do it although he is not virtuous because he is right in what he tries to do. All revolutions have been made by monsters. Lenin was a monster, but he was right. And so it's I have even formulated it in my book, Art of Revolution, in this strange sense that these violent outbreaks prove their necessity and their meaning when the bearers of the flag, of the standard, of the banner of the revolution don't deserve it in their own makeup, you see, to be listened to. Because it's not purely the cause, purely the necessity that somebody must do it, which forces the rest of mankind to follow or to abide by their achievement. Robespierre was such a man, a human monster, but he's made perhaps a republic. That's perhaps too profound for you. At this moment I'm struggling before opening the full machinery of history before your eyes. I want to give you one straight yardstick. And I don't know if I have convinced you, gentlemen. As long as you look into human history from the viewpoint of the ordinary, fragmentarized citizen, the great conversions and the great donations and the great creations of mankind will look to you as mysteries. And you'll say, this is, to me, ununderstandable. As soon as I can get you away from your fragmentary and polite existence as members of the Rotary Club, there's hope that we can agree. Because then you look into your own life in reverse order. You say the very few moments in which you are wholehearted are the moments that count. And the rest is expectation and how do you call the momentum. I mean, the after the machine has come to a stop, then it's still moving, but rather slowly. After, how do you call this, the last phase?
Inertia.
And modern man has made the desperate effort to judge the great progress in history by his, from his own inertia. gentlemen, that's absolutely silly. You have to look into your own power to move before you can understand movement. But here you sit in to see as an inert mass, as a man who wants the security, as a man who wants to have children and a pleasant home and all the facilities and the standard of living and the dishwasher and the washing machine, I cannot understand Valet Forge. It's just a mystery. They didn't even have dicks against their coat. And that's how you want it. I cannot make you understand history. That's how they have to teach history in the history department, because they do not come out into the open, my friends, there, and tell you that you have no access to history as long as you do not feel that the normal person in you is that person whose heart is beating higher. They tell you that the normal person is the one faint-hearted whose heart isn't beating at all. Or at least it mustn't be mentioned that he has a heart. He has just a brain. Or he has lusts. Or he has passions, perhaps, of the lower order. Gentlemen, really? Do you really believe for a moment that you can understand the creation of the human race, which comes by tremendous passions of jealousy, of love, of hate, of imagination, that you can sit there and stare at history by going to a museum and look at the dead ends there, the furniture which is left behind from our ancestors? You cannot. You can only read the textbook of the human race if you are willing, and I think for a young man it's perfectly normal, to admit that the real man is the man who is excited and exuberant. And the other people in you, inside you, are the polite fragments which we meet on the street and which are meet here in class and which are saving face. We always say the Orientals want to save face. Gentlemen, never believe it. Whenever you see a newspaper writer in America especially pretend that in the Orient it is so important to save face, turn around and say, but it isn't half as important in the Orient as it is in America. In America you have to save face all the time. Once you have lost face, out you go. Isn't that true? Why do we always say the Orientals try to save face? Chiang Kai-shek or some Mao or Chu. I mean, every American tries desperately to save face. Perfectly normal, by the way, in any human society. It's nothing objectionable, but we should not make it understandable by looking at others and say they try to save this. You should see that everybody tries to save this. Isn't that true? You try to save this at this moment. I do not, gentlemen. That makes a teacher. And then a teacher is a man who dares, that's my risk. The speculator at the stock exchange risks his capital. I risk my reputation. That is, if I cannot teach you, if I want, would we consider this question of saving peace? And that's a worthwhile action, therefore. And I teach all the better, the more I'm perfectly indifferent to the fact that some of you think I'm ridiculous. All right, let you say I'm ridiculous. That doesn't alter the fact that the only way in which I can try to teach you, I may not succeed, gentlemen, but if I wouldn't take the risk to fail, I would not be able ever to succeed. Now, most people say you must teach in such a way that you can never fail. My answer would be that you can never succeed. And that's, of course, the standard of teaching which you have learned in public schools. I once had an argument with a teacher. I said, I have taught all my life since I was 12, and you have taught too. What's the principle of teaching? Is it to teach one man well, or to teach a class of 30 or 40 children as an average? And he had gone to seminar, and so of course he was very violent and against me and said, you have to keep a class of 30 going, and nothing much must happen, you must never fail completely. And I said, then you never know what's good teaching. He always keeps his even keel. And I think the yardstick is one father teaches his son, or one man teaches the other. That's the best. And all the rest must comply and must behave according to this greatest situation of teaching. We never agreed. He was my brother-in-law, and he was very angry with me. And there is just, you can never argue this point. In this moment and in the world, the majority of people tell you that you have to keep going at an average in society, and that's teaching. At the slightest loss of face, with no excitement on each side, and you're absolutely sure that at the end people will know that 2 and 2 is 4.
What would you say the relation was between losing or
saving?
What is the relationship between losing or saving face and shame?
Not at this moment. Not at this moment. I think we come to this when we describe the origins of human society. So allow me not to go into it. Gentlemen, what do we have done? I wanted to tell you that if you want to participate in our acquired faculties as a human being, you will have to admit that at every moment we have to recognize these faculties. We have to recognize that they are acquired by the risk of losing faith, by giving up our fragmentary apparition in society and becoming wholehearted. And that the quality can only be renewed in you and me if you renew the risk, and if you take the trouble of recognizing what has happened. So these four actions are inevitable if any new quality shall be acquired and transmitted. The man who invents writing must first say, from now on we shall write. That's recognition. The new quality doesn't come about instinctively and doesn't become unknowingly. He must know the full risk, what it means to write. You see what a risk it is. You have forgotten this. The first people shudder should they be writing. The Incas in Peru forbade writing because it seemed to them a deadly sin. You have to recognize the new quality, and you have to bring it about wholeheartedly. That's all it. At the risk of your reputation, at the risk of our polite existence.
You have to risk. How would we call the keep smiling situation?
At the risk of the well, of our state. You can only acquire this quality yourself at some risk and at the recognition of the risk involved in the first act. Without the respect, gentlemen, for the
Declaration come in the Navy. Where's that?
What?
Where's the Declaration?
Well, I meant to see about recognition. Recognition. That is what means the Declaration. I could put it much simpler, gentlemen. Our fathers, again, I tread on your toes, sir, but I am doing it, going to do it. The founding fathers of this country, Benjamin, declared in the Declaration of Independence what they were doing. And they lost face with the 300,000 loyalists who were all the rich people of this country. And the good situated people. For example, the president of Columbia University, which was then called, how was it called? In Scotland. He had to flee and jump out of the window and go to Canada. But he was, of course, the big shot of the time. And the good people, gentlemen, cannot make our views. They leave. So we lost face in the first generation to all the British established values. And you can't can, without the 4th of July celebration, not join into this. The 4th of July in the calendar, gentlemen, is a faint reminder that the ordinary 364 days in which you are not celebrating the 4th of July may make you forget the founding of the United States. Therefore, the 4th of July has to bring you back to your senses. The 4th of July, gentlemen, is a very thin cord by which you are connected with the Founding Father in re-recognizing their recognition, the act of their recognition, the Declaration of Independence. This is so simple, gentlemen, that modern Americans have completely overlooked it. And the connection which I try to establish at this moment is the following. The days of the calendar, which we call holidays, are the days in which the acquired faculties try to make themselves known to you again. They are not luxurious days. You cannot invent Father Day and Mother Day. They are of the devil. This country at this moment is destroying its heritage by inventing holidays. But a holy day is a day where the whole man has to conquer the common man or the ordinary man. Therefore, it's this whole discussion, gentlemen, which has, seems to me perhaps to be one of logical approach. I could not avoid it because you are trained only in argument of the mind, ordinary, extraordinary, wholehearted, and fragmentary. The real story of living people is, of course, in the days which they celebrate and the days in which they forget their origin every day. The common, the weekday, gentlemen, and the Sunday are the holy days and the working day. The tension or are the reality inside which any community lives. There can be no society without holidays. Cannot be. There can be, will you take this down, gentlemen? There can be no society without holidays because on the holiday, the recognition of the acquired faculty is brought home to every member of the community. He may know it or not, that doesn't matter. You see, it has nothing to do with his understanding what's happening to him. It happens to him. You have learned to sneer at all this and think that's for children, gentlemen, and you are so far superior because you have learned abstract logic. Well, you are in great danger of losing the connection with the march of history. You are uprooted, you are nihilists, you are skeptics, you are analyzed, you're good for nothing. We are, as educated people in this country at this moment, in danger of becoming the dregs of civilization. I told Mrs. Roosevelt once at a dinner, I was guest of honor, she asked me what I thought of my new country of adoption. That was 20 years ago. And so I said to her, the common man in this country is just wonderful. I would have to embrace him. But the rich and educated people, they deserve to be shot. Well, it was the time of Algiers and of Miss Bill Remington. And I had a point, I think, because they just played with everything, with communism and with anarchy and with nihilism and with analysis. A friend of mine came back from New York and said he had just been to a party where the men said to him, oh, you know, let's drink one more. At this moment, my wife's just going to bed with a Negro. You see, you have to be civilized. You can't do anything against it. That's the kind of civilized man we had in this country among the rich. And it had never been such a degradation before the since the Roman Empire or the times of Louis XIV, of the 30s of this century. Absolute moral deprivation. And therefore, gentlemen, you are still in this line of succession. You have to redeem yourself. And the one way in which I try to show you that you can redeem yourself at any minute, that's the wonderful freedom of man, is that you take your discrepancy, seriously, between the ordinary life, which we have to live day by day by hard work, and the rhythm of every 24-hour day, and the great calendar, which reminds us what is expected from us, which we have not yet done, which is unfulfilled. The days of the calendar of a society, gentlemen, are promises and expectations. Will you take down these words? They are very strange to you. Promises and expectations. And because they are memories, they are prophecies. Every memory that deserves to be remembered is a prophecy that you may have to say it to. I had just to translate an English book of mine this morning into German, and three sentences stand out. It was written about the Second World War. And I had correspondence with some of you, older men, of course, at that time in the Navy and in the Army. And we said that all the trite things of common everyday life would have to come and get their new splendor. Life was trite. Life was boring. So before the war, and so people just got new and incentive, I mean stimuli, as you say. They want to be stimulated all the time. So they got stimulation, and so they went to hell. On stimulation, you cannot live. Stimulated, you become a dope peddler. Stimulate, you can yourself by cocktails, you can yourself by marijuana and by anything. Stimulation is no criterion, gentlemen. So I said, we said, that was a correspondence which was printed in 1946, that the trite life on Main Street in a little town in America had seemed so trite, so boring, so meaningless, that we never wanted to undertake the impossible, to change the world anymore, because it seemed not worth it. So the problem was, when we came home out of this war, these young men wrote, that we would have to look at the things of the past as new things to come. That we would have to look at the words that seemed so used up as names newly to be invoked. We would have to look at the routines as powers newly to be created. That shows you what is meant, gentlemen, by this strange discrepancy between your common day life and your holiday. On a holiday, you feel able to create the universe. And on a work day, you feel able to work in this inside this universe, but you are responsible for its order. You are fragmentarized. The Marxians make very much and rightly out of the division of labor. On a holiday, the division of labor disappears. We are all before we divide. The whole man, everyone is wholehearted. Every man could sign the Declaration of Independence. Everybody could go out to Valley Forge. He is not just a blacksmith or a carpenter or a student on a holiday, gentlemen. He is the whole man. So wholeheartedness, believe me, is an essential category. Although your causes in humanity never mention this. I'm afraid that the American college professor is famous for his faint-heartedness. And the American men too. When Monsieur Corbusier, the great architect, came to this country, looked around and looked at the things, and except for Frank Lloyd Wright, he said, oh, this is a great nation of 160 million people, and they all are timid souls. Timid souls. And the more you are athletic and football heroes, the more timid souls you are. That's so very strange. The fact that you have strong muscles, gentlemen, and that you have a fine body doesn't mean that you are not very faint-hearted. Because you only think of physical courage.
physical courage is a very second-rate faculty. It's a very beautiful faculty. I envy people who have it. You can acquire it, however. I'm by nature a coward. But a coward is a man who is frightened at the wrong moment, so you can train yourself not to be a coward. The greatest marshal of Prussia said, cowards we are all. But the difference between the courageous man and the coward is that the courageous man is, besides being a coward, something else too. The coward is just a coward. It isn't good, gentlemen, in mental life to be just a coward, I assure you. The holiday, isn't it, your occasion to build up this central power. The human heart is never a coward when it is mobilized. It has infinite, as I said, infinite strength and infinite resources. And peace, the program then is, gentlemen, the holidays which we have established in history, you wouldn't believe it, are the days through which you are admonished and summoned and enabled to become complete and to reacquire all the acquisitions of the human race. Today I got a Valentine. And let me end on this rather joyful note. It was a very nice card, the usual card with a heart in the middle. 14th of February. You know what a great day this was? Oh, regiment. One of the greatest institutions of humanity. In the old world, of the old system of clans and totems and tribes, on every 14th of February, the whole community betrothed the mature women and boys of the community. That is, on the 14th of February, they were got all engaged to marry. And that was done wholesale. You see, they had mass production of marriages at that time. And the 14th of February was not just Valentine's Day, but was a very great day because the community, before the boys had to go to war in spring, got ready. And any boy who goes to war gets engaged and marries before so that he can may leave behind a child, who then can grow up to be a warrior if he should be killed in war. It was a very simple and very, you may say, coarse, very primitive order, but a very order, a very stable order that has kept going, as you see, from this Valentine Day to this day. The dim memory of a Valentine, you see, where you greet the sweetheart of your choice, you see, is the last reminder that people celebrated this wholeheartedness, where you meet and where you procreate the race, that they honored this by making it the central holiday of the order of the clans. We have still laws and statutes, gentlemen, in which is carefully stated how this should be done and how girls or boys who felt wronged in the choice that was made then might, so to speak, mend this wrong choice, because not everybody was very happy, you know, with the selection that went on in such a way. If everybody has to get married, you see, and all the girls and all the boys, you may think what a hardship is involved. The last reminder of this is in the dance, when you go to a dance and the girl finds no partner and has to sit there all evening long because nobody's going to dance with her. This is a very small thing, the great tragedy when a girl remains unmarried who is ready and destined to marry. Today goes on behind closed doors. Nobody knows it. She just weeps in her own bedchamber. But in those days, the people faced the simple fact, gentlemen, that you are wholehearted when you marry. That is the condition of power. Man is impotent when he is not wholehearted. And I think you should therefore respect a little bit history
as a, just your own history written large. The history reminds you of wedding days of the human race, where men were fools. Believe it or not, gentlemen, the 4th of July deserves to be celebrated. Thank you.